Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 has been described as one of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation and one of the most transformational laws ever passed. It suspended literacy tests across the South, authorized the Attorney General to file lawsuits to challenge the poll tax, and forced states with the worst histories of voter discrimination to clear all electoral changes with the federal government to prevent future discrimination. Now, while the use of poll taxes and literacy tests are long gone, the attacks on voting rights continue to gain momentum, especially in recent years. Throughout the country, Republican-dominated state legislatures have passed laws that disenfranchise poor, young, and black and brown voters by reducing early voting, ending same-day registration, changing voter eligibility, and implementing voter ID requirements, just to name a few. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, since 2010, 21 states have passed new voting restriction laws. In 15 states, these restrictions will be in effect for the very first time in next year's presidential election. So where is the struggle for voting rights today, and what can we learn from the civil rights movement and the fight for the right to vote? In his new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, the nation's Ari Berman writes that the U.S. is the only advanced democracy that has ever enfranchised and then re-enfranchised an entire segment of the population. Ari Berman is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about politics, civil rights, and the intersection of money and politics. And Ari joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Ari. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and huge congratulations for your book. I have at least 10 pages of notes on my desk. I mean, I learned so much from your
book. Luckily, we have an hour.
Yes, exactly. I learned so much from your book, and I just kept thinking, why is this not common knowledge? From John Roberts' time during the Reagan administration, where he was fighting to gut the VRA, and then successfully did it as a Supreme Court justice, to all of the laws that have passed across the country that specifically affect mostly women, young people, and people of color. So first off, I want to ask you, since you did amazing research on this book, what really shocked you the most?
Well, as to your question of why more people don't know about this, I think there's just generally speaking a problem in terms of how we understand the civil rights movement and how we understand the voting rights struggle. So many accounts of the voting rights movement end in 1965 with the triumphant march from Selma to Montgomery and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. Or they end a few years later in 1968 with the death of Martin Luther King as the death of the civil rights movement. So we either hear about the great triumph of the civil rights movement, or we hear about the death of the civil rights movement, and we're left to wonder 50 years later what has happened. So it was critically important to me to tell the story of what happened after 1965, because I think a lot of people don't know the next phase of the struggle, the next phase of the story. And if you really want to understand everything that's happening now, as you mentioned, John Roberts' role against the Voting Rights Act or new voting restrictions being passed today, you first have to understand that the debate over voting rights, the struggle over voting rights, didn't end after 1965.
And so there are really important chunks of history that led us to where we are today. And we could probably spend an hour on all of those. But which one do you think best helps us understand how we got here?
Well, do you mean which event was pivotal in terms of the passage of the Voting Rights Act?
Yes.
Or what helps us understand why the right to vote remains so contested?
The second one, why it remains so contested. And well, just, you know, how did we get to a place where, I mean, you have the numbers. Hundreds of thousands of people did not vote in 2014 because they couldn't. So how did we get to that place?
Well, you have to kind of go back, and I think you first have to look at American history and realize that we fought a civil war. We passed three amendments to the Constitution to make real the promise of equality after the Civil War, the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment. And the 15th Amendment said very clearly that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And we aggressively enforced the 15th Amendment for a period of time. There were federal troops in the South. They registered voters. They monitored elections. We had black senators and governors from states like Louisiana and Mississippi. Nothing that's ever occurred since. But what happened is, after the disputed election of 1876, is federal troops pulled out of the South. Reconstruction came to an end, and we began to see things like literacy tests, poll taxes, grandfather clauses, backed up by wide-scale violence and fraud against black voters. And the Jim Crow era began, and Reconstruction ended, and that lasted essentially until 1965, when we passed the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act did a tremendous amount of good, as you mentioned in your introduction. It abolished things like literacy tests. It sent federal examiners to the South to register voters in massive numbers. It kept federal officials in the South to monitor elections. It forced those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination to have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. All of that was transformational. But the problem was that the backlash against voting rights, the backlash against civil rights, didn't end with the Voting Rights Act. That the same kind of things that we saw during the Jim Crow era morphed in different forms in terms of the backlash to the Voting Rights Act. And so this debate was never settled. And if you want to understand why there's a whole new struggle over voting rights today, the first thing you have to understand is that the Voting Rights Act itself was never accepted by a pretty influential segment of society who have been trying to chip away at it for 50 years.
Right. The section on Reagan and John Roberts is really interesting. You write that Ronald Reagan told a biographer during the 1980 campaign that the Voting Rights Act had been, quote, humiliating to the South. You also have really interesting information here about Ronald Reagan kicking off his general election campaign for president in Neshoba County, Mississippi, where civil rights activists James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner had been murdered in 1964. And at the time, Ronald Reagan told a nearly all-white crowd at the county fair, quote, "I believe in states' rights." Talk about the significance of that.
So one of the main storylines in my book is that there is this counter-revolution against civil rights and against the Voting Rights Act. And Reagan is really the pivotal figure in the counter-revolution because he is someone who opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1980. So he was really radical on civil rights issues, yet nonetheless, he was elected with very, very broad margin. So he was the most influential figure in the counter-revolution because he actually held these extremely radical views on civil rights, but was nonetheless elected and widely perceived by many as a popular and effective president. And so Reagan does not – many politicians moderate after 1965, and they support civil rights and they support the Voting Rights Act, including many Republicans. Ronald Reagan is not one of them. He is one of those people that believe that the federal government really shouldn't have the power to rectify historic instances of discrimination. And the fact that he goes to Neshoba County, Mississippi, where Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner were murdered in 1964, and he speaks of the Neshoba County Fair, which is a hotbed. Everyone knows it's a hotbed of segregationist resistance. And he says the words, "I believe in states' rights," which everyone knows for so many years had been a code word for segregation, for maintaining white supremacy. That just signaled the kind of administration that Reagan would lead. And what we see is that after taking office, there's this broader counter-revolution in the Reagan years. And we see people like John Roberts, who at that time is a young lawyer, coming of age by opposing the civil rights laws of the 1960s.
You also have really interesting information about infighting, how some people under Reagan were so adamant on rolling back the Voting Rights Act. But as you write, a lot of the Republicans realized that they just couldn't do that. That would be political suicide. So can you talk about some of the behind-the-scenes tensions that you learned about?
There was a lot of behind-the-scenes tension, both within the Justice Department and also between the Congress and the Reagan administration. You have to realize that the Justice Department for many years faithfully carried out the Voting Rights Act. And they viewed their job as enforcing the civil rights laws of the 1960s. And suddenly Reagan comes in and doesn't believe in the civil rights laws of the 1960s, doesn't support them, appoints people like his assistant attorney general for civil rights, William Bradford Reynolds, who argues that these laws are forms of quote-unquote government-sponsored discrimination. So the Reagan administration is making a radically new argument. They're making the argument that these laws that are meant to stop discrimination have become in and of themselves discriminatory. And the lawyers in the Justice Department who are enforcing the Voting Rights Act, they think this is absolutely insane, this new argument, because they're seeing the Voting Rights Act rectify centuries of discrimination in American society, and then suddenly the Reagan administration is coming in and calling these very laws discriminatory. At the same time, there's a big battle between the Reagan administration and the Congress, because the Voting Rights Act, parts of it are due to expire in the early 1980s. And there's a strong block of moderates to pragmatic conservatives in the Congress that want to restore the Voting Rights Act, want to reauthorize it. And the Reagan administration doesn't really want to do that. And so there's a big fight, and what you see is that high-profile moderates in the Republican Party, people like Bob Dole, the senator from Kansas, stand up to Reagan. And actually, the Voting Rights Act is reauthorized for a long period of time and is strengthened during the Reagan era. But it's not done without a very major fight.
And you point out that it was the strongest and most bipartisan Voting Rights Act ever enacted.
Yeah, so the backstory to the 1982 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, and let me just say in big picture, the temporary provisions of the Voting Rights Act, particularly the fact that those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination have to approve their voting changes with the federal government, those have to be renewed. And they've been renewed four times by the Congress, in 1970, in 1975, in 1982, and in 2006. And in the 80s, there was a huge fight because the Supreme Court had ruled in a case for Mobile that you had to show intentional discrimination to strike down an election system that prevented African Americans from being elected. So Mobile was one of these cities which was a third African American, but all the elections were done on a citywide basis. And so if whites wouldn't vote for a black candidate, then African Americans were shut out from influence in that city. And this was a situation that existed all across the South, even decades after the Voting Rights Act. And what the Supreme Court said is that you had to have some sort of smoking gun that showed that this kind of election system was passed to discriminate against blacks and Hispanics. You couldn't just show that it did discriminate against blacks and Hispanics. And it was very, very difficult to prove this kind of intentional discrimination. By the 1980s, people who opposed voting rights had become more sophisticated. They just weren't saying outright racist things anymore. So the fact that this new requirement of intentional discrimination was required by the Supreme Court was the most severe blow to the Voting Rights Act at that period of time. And when these very ideological Reaganites take over the Justice Department, they are really dead set on making it so that it's as hard to prove violations under the Voting Rights Act as possible. And a key leader in that fight, who you mentioned earlier, is John Roberts. And it's basically John Roberts' job to try to preserve the finding of intentional discrimination. And he writes the requirement that you have to show intentional discrimination. And Roberts writes memo after memo after memo in the Reagan Justice Department arguing that an expansive reading of the Voting Rights Act will lead to things like quotas in the electoral sphere will lead to affirmative action in electoral politics, which is an argument that the Reagan administration is making all across the board with civil rights, opposing any kind of affirmative action or what they view as preferential treatment for minorities. And so Roberts is in a huge fight with the Congress on this. They lose this fight. The Congress overrules the Reagan administration. They overrule the Supreme Court. They restore the fact that you don't have to show intentional discrimination. And that leads, in the decades after, to a huge increase in minority representation and in real political power for historically disenfranchised groups. But had the Reagan administration and John Roberts won that fight in the 1980s, we would see, I think, far fewer people of color in elected office today.
Well, Ari, before we even started, we got a call from a listener. So on this topic of John Roberts, let's hear from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I realize he wasn't the main focus of your book, but I'd like you to speculate about the reasons for his long opposition to the Voting Rights Act. Was it because he's a believer in conservative states' rights principles, or is he just an out-and-out racist?
Well, I will say that John Roberts is a major character in my book, and I can't speculate as to his motives. I think that Roberts came of age at a time in the 1980s where there was this major backlash to the civil rights laws of the 1960s in conservative legal circles. Before joining the Reagan administration, Roberts clerked for Justice William Rehnquist. And Rehnquist was the most conservative member of the court on civil rights issues. When Nixon appointed him in the 1970s, he was called the Lone Ranger because he was so far out there, particularly on issues of civil rights. He was someone who, for example, believed that Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided. He believed that an all-white Democratic Party primary in Texas was constitutional, and he personally administered literacy tests to Black and Hispanic voters when he was a Republican Party official in Arizona. So the fact that Roberts worked for Rehnquist showed that he was at the very least quite sympathetic to the states' rights views being championed by Rehnquist. And then when he joined the Reagan administration, you clearly saw that Roberts was in sync with the Reagan administration's view that these civil rights laws had become discriminatory. So I think Roberts is someone who fused the old school states' rights conservatism of someone like Rehnquist with this quote unquote colorblind conservatism that the Reagan administration was espousing. And he clearly was very influenced by these major trends in conservative legal circles at the time.
Well, thank you for the question, Frank. And today we are speaking with Ari Berman about his new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It is a really great book because it reveals so much of history that's so important. And it tells us how we really got here today. Why did we have in 2014, we did a show about this, the lowest voter turnout in 72 years. He's got a really interesting number. Texas, for example, one of the strongest voting ID laws in the country. We'll talk about that later. Despite a high-profile governor's race between the Republican Greg Abbott and the Democrat Wendy Davis, voter turnout in Texas dropped by 270,000 votes in 2014 compared with 2010. Only 28% of eligible voters went to the polls, the second lowest turnout rate in the country. What explains this, and why isn't this getting more attention in the media? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. It's really hard to keep up with all of these new voting restrictions. So if you have any questions about this, luckily in California, we are not facing this. In fact, California politicians are trying to make it easier for us to vote, but we are an anomaly across the country. So what questions do you have for Ari about restrictions on voting? Why would they curtail early voting? Why would they shut down registration drives? What explains this? Well, when you look at who this actually affects, women, young people, people of color, what are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255. All right, so this comes full circle for John Roberts. So when you take a look at Section 5, which Congressman John Lewis called the heart and soul of the Voting Rights Act and one of the most vital tools of our democracy. So first off, just give us a brief explanation of Section 5 and why it's so important, or was so,
Section 5 was the part of the Voting Rights Act that compelled those states with the longest histories of voting discrimination to have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And they did so because after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, those states that had long discriminated, like Mississippi, began changing their voting systems to make it harder for newly registered African-American voters to actually run for office, to be elected to office, to participate meaningfully in what was becoming a new democracy. And the Supreme Court said to these states, interpreting the law from Congress, that you do have to approve your voting changes with the federal government to make sure that you don't discriminate in the future. One of the reasons why Reconstruction ended and the Voting Rights Act was needed was because after the initial promise of Reconstruction, states like Mississippi were allowed to pass things like poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses. And what the Voting Rights Act said is to Mississippi and those other southern states, you're not going to be able to do this again. We're not going to pass a Voting Rights Act of 1966 or 1967 because the Voting Rights Act is going to try to solve this problem of voting discrimination once and for all. And that this is going to have to be an extraordinary remedy because these places in the South had disregarded the 15th Amendment and disregarded basic human rights for such a long time. And so Section 5 was really the most important part of the Voting Rights Act. In no other part of the law did the federal government have the ability to stop discrimination before it actually occurred. And what we saw is that from 1965 to 2013, when the Supreme Court gutted Section 5, is that that part of the law had stopped 3,000 discriminatory voting changes from becoming law. And so this was something that didn't just matter in the 1960s. It was relevant in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and all the way through until today.
Right. And you also report that under George W. Bush, Voting Rights Act enforcement came to a standstill. So from 2001 to 2005, the DOJ objected to only 48 voting changes out of 81,000 submitted. That's 10 times fewer than during the first 4 years of the Reagan administration.
Well, the Bush administration was a major turning point. I mean, things got so bad during the Bush 2 years that veterans of the Civil Rights Division during the Reagan years were referring to the Reagan administration as the good old days.
Wow.
Because the Bush administration was even more political and politicized and ideological than the Reagan administration was, and you had people in there that were doing everything they could to try to not just gut the Voting Rights Act, but to politicize the Civil Rights Division of the Voting Rights Act, which had long been viewed as the crown jewel of the Justice Department that had enforced the Voting Rights Act for so many years. And what you see in the Bush administration is not just this broader turn against the Voting Rights Act, but the appointment of two justices on the Supreme Court, Sam Alito and John Roberts, who have very hostile views to the Voting Rights Act. So the Bush administration is so important, not just for what it did in office, but the fact that it created this legacy for restricting voting rights, unfortunately, for many years to come.
And John Ashcroft plays a big role here. You report that when John Ashcroft lost his Senate race to Mel Carnahan, Missouri's Governor Mel Carnahan died in a plane crash 3 weeks before the election. His name remained on the ballot and his wife Jean ran in his stead. And you report that John Ashcroft was just shocked that he was losing to, quote, a dead man. And then after he lost by 49,000 votes, Bush nominated Ashcroft as his attorney general.
Yeah, so there's an interesting backstory in the 2000 election in St. Louis that I think most people don't know about, which is that before the election, the St. Louis Board of Elections mailed voter registration forms to many people. And those people whose forms were, for some reason or another, returned as undeliverable were taken off the voting rolls without being notified. And there was a lot of errors in terms of how this mailing was done. So many people were removed from the voting rolls who, in fact, were eligible and registered voters. And so people showed up on election day in St. Louis and found that they weren't on the voting rolls. They went to the Board of Elections downtown. It was a major fiasco. There was extremely long lines. A lot of people weren't able to vote. And so the Gore campaign in 2000 petitioned a judge in St. Louis to keep the polls open for 3 extra hours there. And the judge in St. Louis initially agreed to do that. Then the Bush campaign filed an appeal. The courts, a higher court, shut down these extended polling hours after only 45 minutes. Only a few hundred people had been able to vote during that period of time. Nonetheless, Missouri Republicans were furious. They believed that this was an attempt to illegitimately oust John Ashcroft from office by keeping the polling hours open for longer. Kit Bond, who at that point was a senior senator from Missouri, got up on election night and slammed his fist down at the podium and said, "The Democrats are trying to steal the election in St. Louis." It was like it was 1960 Chicago all over again, when supposedly dead voters had voted for JFK over Nixon. And so what happens is, after Ashcroft loses this election, Bush appoints him as attorney general, and this new right-wing voter fraud craze begins. And so all the rhetoric that we hear about voter fraud today, it really begins with the Bush administration and John Ashcroft.
And after the break, we'll talk about the voter ID laws that have resulted because of that. And then also the Paul Weyrich. That's a really interesting story you share in your book about the guy who really started the voter ID trend. And today we're talking with Ari Berman. He is author of the new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin here with Joe Burke, taking just a moment to ask for your support for your call on this first day of our September membership campaign. We have Ari Berman's new book, Give Us the Ballot, yours for a $120 contribution to KALW. It's about increasing your knowledge about our democracy and the way that it works. That's what this book is about, and that is what your call does on a daily basis and asks for your participation. That's what makes KALW go, and your call at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org will make sure these kinds of in-depth conversations on your call continue.
Again, that number is 800-525-9917, or you can go online and click KALW.org and look for the donate button. It's very easy to do. One of the advantages online is you can take your time scrolling through the gifts we have available, including the book that Matt just mentioned. Our phone volunteers have all of that information as well. It's a toll-free number, 800-525-9917.
If you've never been a member of your public radio station before, this is a great time on this first day of this brief campaign, just 10 days. The last time we'll be asking for your support until May of 2016. So you get involved now. You're going to feel a little bit like that first time you vote when you go, ah, this is what people are doing. This is what they're taking part in. This is something really important. Public radio, and especially independent public radio like you get with your call, is so critical. And it is people participating that keep it strong. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
And again, our special thank you gift during this hour of your call, Ari Berman's book, Give Us the Ballot, for a pledge of just $120. 800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org.
800-525-9917. We are going back to the program, keeping the shows intact. That's what you come here for. We're putting that first. Show your support for that approach.
It is the first day of our September membership campaign, and we're inviting you to join us today. 800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. Rose?
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Susan Casey about her new book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. After an amazing encounter with a pod of spinner dolphins in Hawaii, she set out on a two-year worldwide journey to study these amazing intelligent creatures and our relationship with them. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us in our conversation with Ari Berman about voting rights and his new book, Give Us the Ballot, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about voting restrictions? Are you aware of how many laws have been passed across the country and just how difficult it is now for people to vote? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ari, do you think people in California, again, a state where politicians are trying to make it easier, not harder to vote, do you think people understand what's actually happening? Because, you know, we talk about these issues on this show regularly, and my mouth was just dropping so many times during your book, reading about the long lines, how people's names were on voter rolls that were purged, just how hard it was to vote in 2014.
I think that a lot of people don't understand it until it actually happens to them. We saw this, for example, in Texas in 2014, where that state strict voter ID law was in effect, and hundreds, if not thousands, of people were turned away from the polls as a result. And there was someone who, an elderly voter, who couldn't vote because her driver's license was expired, and she didn't realize it until right before the election, and she wasn't able to get to the DMV office at the time. And her daughter, who was her caretaker, said, you know, I didn't understand what all the fuss was about with this voter ID law until it happened to me. And now I'm furious. And so I think it's easy in a place like California, where they're proposing a lot of things to make it easier to vote, from, you know, automatic voter registration to online voter registration to re-enfranchising ex-felons, to not realize what's happening in Texas or North Carolina, where either new requirements are being added or things that were widely popular are being taken away. So it's not just that people face new restrictions. It's that in a place like North Carolina, for example, early voting is being cut back. Same-day registration is being eliminated. And so conveniences that people got used to that led to increased voter turnout are now being taken away, and people are not used to the new system, can't comply with it, and are being turned away as a result, unfortunately.
North Carolina is a good place to look at, because just 3 weeks after Section 5, well, Section 4 was overturned, Section 5, North Carolina had some of the highest turnout in the country because there were all of these great laws on the books. Same-day registration, young people were registering registration voter drives, but 3 weeks after that happened, things switched. So talk about just how it happened so quickly.
So what happened in North Carolina was that, as you mentioned, after the Supreme Court struck down that requirement that those states, including North Carolina, with a long history of voting discrimination, had to approve their voting changes, North Carolina passed this sweeping rewrite of its election law, seemingly out of nowhere, that not just added a strict new voter ID requirement, but cut early voting, eliminated same-day voter registration, eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, which was taught in high school civics class, eliminated Citizen Awareness Month, which encouraged people to register to vote. It was such an insane piece of legislation. And you mentioned that North Carolina was 37th in voter turnout in 2000. And they began to pass reforms to make it easier to vote. And the state moved from 37th in voter turnout in 2000 to 11th by 2012. So these things worked. We know empirically that when you pass laws that make it easier to vote, more people do vote. I mean, it sounds so logical, but it also happens to be empirically true. What happened in North Carolina was that after these reforms were eliminated, that some of the worst predictions did come true, that thousands of people were eliminated from participating in the political process. They no longer could use same-day registration. For example, they no longer could vote anywhere in their county. That law is now being challenged before the federal court. It's a very lengthy process that we're going through. And in the meantime, there's unfortunately a lot of uncertainty in places like North Carolina as a result of the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act.
And what's so incredible, 2 days later, or 2 days after this happened, that these bills were introduced, Pat McCrory, North Carolina's governor, is he a Republican?
He's a Republican.
Yeah. So he signed the bill. An AP reporter said, why would the legislature eliminate pre-registration for high school students? And he said, I don't know enough. I'm sorry. I haven't seen that part of the bill.
Well, you almost couldn't blame the governor because the bill was passed so quickly. I mean, this was a 14-page bill that overnight became a 57-page bill. And basically, most people barely had time to read it before the Republican legislature passed it. But it goes to show you that they were so intent on doing this, they made all sorts of excuses for why they did it. From voter fraud to restoring integrity of the elections to a variety of other arguments. But the fact that the governor himself couldn't justify parts of the bill just showed that there really was not a good rationale for most of the bill, if not all of it.
And again, so in 2010, 200,000 people in North Carolina voted during the now eliminated first week of early voting. 21,000 used same-day registration. And so Democracy North Carolina estimated that 30,000 to 50,000 voters were kept from the polls in 2014 because of these new laws.
Yeah, we'll never get an exact number. Democracy North Carolina did track down 2,300 people who were prevented from voting because of these new restrictions. They estimated that the total number is a lot higher because you obviously can't find everyone who's kept from the polls. I mean, this is a really chilling development, particularly a chilling development coming after the 2008 election, when we thought there was going to be this unprecedented voter turnout and there was going to be a new electorate that turned out for President Obama, a more diverse, younger and more progressive electorate. And what we're seeing now is attempts by Republicans to instead make the electorate older, whiter, and more conservative. And I think most shamefully smaller than it was before, that the voter turnout, instead of being viewed as a good thing, it was actually viewed as a negative. And so even though we have such low voter turnout already in our country, we have among the lowest rates of any advanced industrial democracy, we are still, instead of making it easier to vote, far too many states are instead making it harder to vote.
And it's important to point out, as you did in your book, the 2008 electorate was the most diverse in history. Of the 5 million new voters in 2008, 2 million were black, 2 million were Hispanic, 600,000 were Asian, and study after study shows that mostly people of color are the people that take advantage of early voting, same-day registration, all of these rules, or they should be rights that people have, but are now being gutted by mostly Republican politicians across the country. And now that we are seeing the fact that a lot of people are not able to vote, the studies show that it's mostly affecting people of color.
Well, it's certainly true that historically disenfranchised communities, historically disadvantaged communities, are the ones who need these reforms the most. That we see, for example, consistently the longest lines are usually in minority polling places, for example, that have fewer resources, fewer polling machines. That's why in Ohio in 2004, for example, we saw very long lines in places like Cleveland and Columbus, but not in, similar Republican suburbs in the state. And so the broad expansion of voting rights, I think, was beneficial to all Americans. I mean, in those states with early voting, everybody used early voting. In North Carolina, 70% of people used early voting in 2008 and 2012. But we saw that it was particularly beneficial for those segments of the society that were prevented from one reason or another in participating historically. And so it didn't just violate the letter of the Voting Rights Act. It really violated the whole spirit of the Voting Rights Act when things were done to try to make it harder to vote that particularly affected those communities that the Voting Rights Act was meant to protect.
And also, when you look at voter ID, for example, a voter ID is required to vote, but it's not required for people who turn in absentee ballots. Those are usually, whites. That's what the studies tell us. You had a really interesting piece of info in your book about voter ID. You report that in 1980, Paul Weyrich, the tart-tongued first director of the Heritage Foundation, convened a gathering of 15,000 evangelical Christians for Ronald Reagan. And he said, quote, "I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down," end quote. I mean, that says it all. And Weyrich is the key founder of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yeah, so that statement that the Republican Party's leverage goes up as the turnout goes down, I think, was the widespread mantra for the Republican Party officials who are making it harder to vote after the 2008 election. And ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, who you mentioned earlier, which paired corporate interests with state legislatures, they drew up model voter ID legislation in 2008. And what happened is after all the state legislatures flipped from blue to red after the 2010 election and the triumph of the Tea Party, is that we started to see the same legislation being introduced in state by state by state. Texas, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, they were suddenly all requiring strict voter ID, which they had never required before. And they suddenly were saying that there was this incredible prevalence of voter fraud that no one had ever found before. And the real irony of this whole voter ID discussion, as you mentioned earlier, is that voter impersonation, which voter ID laws try to stop, is incredibly rare. There have been many studies on this, and they found that out of 1 billion votes cast since 2000, there's only been 30 credible cases of voter impersonation. So it's just an incredibly rare problem. The bigger problem, to the extent that there is any fraud in American elections, is absentee ballot fraud. And nonetheless, so many of these voter ID laws, including in Texas, exempt absentee ballots from the voter ID requirement, which leads one to ask, if they're really about stopping voter fraud, why aren't they going after the fraud that exists, absentee ballot fraud, instead of ignoring the fact that voter impersonation fraud is basically non-existent?
Ari Berman is author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good program. Many states have laws that prohibit felons from voting. I've never quite understood the logic of this, because after a person serves his or her sentence and has paid their debt to society, they should be able to act as full citizens. And I was wondering whether, and I know that these laws discriminate particularly against minority people and poor people, And I was wondering what the whether these laws are under legal challenge and what the logic is supporting them.
All right. Thank you, John.
Well, it's a big issue now, and I'm glad John raised it, particularly in the context of Black Lives Matter and a whole new focus on criminal justice reform. And people are asking themselves, why, after someone has served their time, can't they vote in a place like Florida? Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has declined to find that these sort of felon disenfranchisement laws violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. There have been challenges to felon disenfranchisement laws, and the Supreme Court has declined to rule favorably on them. And so it's really being done on a state-by-state basis. Some states have very progressive laws where, you know, all ex-felons can vote. Other states like Florida have much more restrictive laws that date all the way back to the Jim Crow era where felons can't vote. And these are being challenged in state courts or by other means. And we are starting to see some bipartisan movement. We've seen, for example, that Rand Paul, for example, from Kentucky has advocated for restoring voting rights to nonviolent ex-felons. So this is the one part of the voting rights struggle where there does seem to be some sort of bipartisan movement today. Unfortunately, it's not enough right now, and these laws still exist in too many places.
Well, so because we were talking about felons, and George W. Bush did put John Roberts on the Supreme Court, who was instrumental in overturning Section 5, I think this is really worth revisiting. You report that before the 2011 election, Florida sent its 67 county election supervisors a list of 58,000 alleged felons to purge from the voting rolls. Blacks made up 15% of registered voters in Florida, but 44% of those on the purge list. A $4 million contract went to the Boca Raton-based Database Technologies. This is a company recommended by a conservative advocacy group called the Voting Integrity Project. So talk a little bit about the purge list and what the NAACP sued, and then we learned about the number of people on that list who ultimately could not vote in the 2000 presidential election in Florida.
Yeah, this was an absolutely chilling turning point in American history because thousands of people, as you mentioned, were wrongly labeled as felons in Florida. They were disproportionately African American. They showed up on election day and were told they couldn't vote. They were wrongly told they couldn't vote because they were wrongly labeled as felons. And this was happening all across the state of Florida, particularly to African-American voters who I interviewed for my book. And after the election, we learned that 12,000 people had been wrongly labeled as felons and potentially prevented from voting. That was 22 times George W. Bush's margin of victory in Florida. And the Civil Rights Commission, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, after the election, found that this purge violated the Voting Rights Act because it was discriminatory towards African-American voters. Unfortunately, at that point, it was too late. George W. Bush had already been elected. And I think the Florida voter purge taught the unfortunate lesson to Republican Party officials that small manipulations in the electoral process, like the voter purge, could have a very big difference in close elections. So it was that voter purge in 2000 in Florida that, in my opinion, laid the groundwork for many more restrictions in the years to come.
And as you point out, Ari, the widespread and wrongful purging of voters, which disproportionately targeted Black voters in Florida, was the most consequential and least discussed aspect of the Florida election. Why? And I feel like today, Jeb Bush is running, for example. Ted Cruz is the one that called John Ashcroft to come to Florida to fight for the Bush team. I mean, these guys are running for president. Why isn't this an issue in the election? Why aren't we hearing anyone talking about this right now?
I think you know, in 2000, people just were uncomfortable discussing race, and they were uncomfortable saying that, you know, maybe the rules were rigged and maybe that benefited one party over the other. And I think to some extent, many people in the media are still uncomfortable saying that. And so they play this false equivalence, or they focus on scandal instead of substance. It's a problem that we have in so many areas. But I do think you're right that this needs to be reexamined, because you mentioned that Ted Cruz was running Bush's recount team. And one of his first calls was to John Roberts, who he clerked for as a fellow Rehnquist clerk. And John Roberts went down and he advised Jeb Bush, who was Florida's governor at the time. So these are all people now that have resurfaced and are they're either the leaders of the Supreme Court or they're the leaders of the Republican Party. And so their roles in this fiasco really need to be reexamined, because I think you can make a very strong argument that the 2000 election was the first in a very long time in which voter suppression really could have decided the outcome, that it's not at all a stretch to believe that that voter purge kept enough people from voting who would have voted for Al Gore, and that the margin was so small that had it not been for the voter purge, we would have had a different president, a different Supreme Court, and we in all likelihood wouldn't be talking about the struggle for voting rights today.
I mean, this is really intense. I just don't understand why this is not getting more attention. I mean, 2014...
Well, I think...
Go ahead.
I think I think voter suppression got a fair amount of attention in the 2012 election, not as much as it should have gotten, but certainly when we saw, for example, the long lines in Florida, that was something that got a lot of national attention. President Obama said, you know, on election night that we have to fix that. Unfortunately, we haven't fixed the problem. It's only gotten worse. And so, you know, I would love to see, you know, all of the coverage that's devoted to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, at least a fraction of that go towards the struggle for voting rights. I thought it was sad that the first Republican debate was on the actual 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and none of the candidates and none of the journalists brought it up.
Right.
And to me, that was instructive of where we're at as a country today, or at least where the Republican Party is at today.
Well, and so where are we at today? Because you report that in 2014, the number of voters potentially affected by new barriers to voting exceeded the margins of victory in close races for Senate and governor in North Carolina, Kansas, Virginia, and Florida. And I feel like after the election of President Obama, a lot of the voting rights activists sort of felt like, well, it was fair this time. We're not going to, you know, keep yelling about this. And it's just rare to even hear Democrats talk about this. So why is that?
Well, I think that the new restrictions caught a lot of people off guard. We thought that the struggle over voting rights had been settled by the president's election. I think a lot of people believed that the Republican Party would have to reach out to new constituencies after Obama's election. I don't think they forecast that instead the Republican Party would make it harder for those constituencies to be able to vote. That was something that, you know, I didn't anticipate. A lot of people didn't anticipate. And so once it started happening, once these new restrictions started being introduced, it was quite shocking. And I was among the first people to report on them. So I've been on the story for a while now. But nonetheless, you know, it was a development that a lot of people didn't foresee. The Democratic Party was, you know, caught off guard. They were demoralized after 2010. It took a while for them to regroup. It took a while for the voting rights groups to get back in action, to challenge these laws, to mobilize people against them. We're seeing a lot more challenges in court now. We're seeing a lot higher mobilization of people, at least on one side of the aisle, the more liberal, progressive, democratic side of the aisle. I think people are outraged about this. The problem is that historically within the Republican Party, there's always been a good segment of Republicans that have been supportive of the Voting Rights Act and have denounced efforts to make it harder to vote. Those voices are now the minority within the Republican Party. And so the loudest voices in the Republican Party are the opponents of voting rights. They're the opponents of civil rights. And that's what you're seeing either in terms of John Roberts on the Supreme Court or Donald Trump as the Republican frontrunner, is that the backlash, the backlash style of politics is winning within the conservative movement right now.
And we don't have time to take Nancy in Berkeley's call, but she says it seems like the Republicans are going to win again because it's so hard to vote. I mean, and as you point out, Ari, it's been so demoralizing for people. You know, older people who voted for so many decades in line told, you're not on the roll, or you're on the wrong roll, and it's very embarrassing. You quote one person saying a lot of blacks have given up on voting because of these restrictions. And in a minute, Nancy says, what can we do about this?
Well, I think it's been demoralizing, but it's also activated a lot of people to realize that there is a new struggle over voting rights and they have to do something about it. And so what we saw in 2012, for example, is that many of these laws backfired, that African-American turnout, for example, increased in states like Ohio, where there had been new efforts to make it harder to vote. So it's not always the case that these laws will simply turn people away. They can motivate more people to want to turn out to overcome these barriers. But there has to be a lot of real organizing efforts, and we also have to recognize that there needs to be broader efforts in the state and on the federal level to make it easier to vote, whether that's restoring the Voting Rights Act or passing election reform or doing any number of other things. The solutions are out there. We just need the political will to implement them.
Ari Berman is author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for this very important book. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar, and it's your call.